And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever thought your dog was laughing? Does your goldfish recognize you? When a red-tailed hawk is soaring on an updraft of air, does it enjoy the sensation? Do animals have feelings and emotions? The answer generally depends on who you're talking to. And today we talk to one of the world's leading researchers into the topic of animal emotions and awareness, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, in this special edition of the Wild Side News. Coming up.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The question of whether animals can actually carry out simple problem solving, that they have the capacity to use simple tools, and that they can respond and even create original solutions to simple problems, has been fairly well resolved by science. It's taken 50 years for laboratory research to get to this point. Research that often subjected the test animals to years of pushing colored buttons on touchscreens, or moving a lever with a nose, or running through mazes, or trying to knock bananas down with a stick. The realms of pure science, looking for neural pathways to understanding not only the primitive animal brain, or the primate's comparative intelligence, say, with a dog, and how all of this would hopefully someday lead to a better understanding of our own mind, has been a long, meticulous path. Another branch of science, ethology, or the study of animal behavior, has taken a different pathway, relying as much as possible on observing animals in their natural state to determine the capabilities of animals when given the chance to express their full matrix of potentials for survival, communication, social dynamics, and mates. And the two approaches have often come into conflict, as a longer ethologist like Jane Goodall spent in close observation of animal communities, the more they concluded that animals were complex, intelligent, feeling creatures. This quest has led to even more challenging questions, and today we go in depth as we explore the emotional lives of animals with one of the world's leading researchers in this field, Dr. Mark Beckhoff. This is, to me, one of the most important questions facing humankind today, and you'll find out why as we devote the entire show to exploring the joy, sorrow, jealousy, fear, rituals, mourning, and passion of our animal friends. It's a show you'll want to listen to in its entirety, but first, today's news. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, at the opening meeting of a summit of Arab leaders in Riyadh Wednesday, called U.S. military presence in Iraq illegitimate and warned that sectarianism could lead to all-out civil war. Analysts claim that uncertainties in the Middle East over the recent arrest of 15 British sailors by the Iranian Navy and a rumor that Iran fired a missile at an American ship in the Persian Gulf sent oil prices back up to their highest point this year, reaching over $68 per barrel, $10 less than its all-time high of $78 reached last July. Fears are being expressed that these events, taking place in the Straits of Hormuz, could affect delivery of oil to the world, most of which flows directly through the Straits. Rumors of a possible U.S. strike on Iran on April 4th through the 6th, empowered by the taking of the 15 Brits, who are talking strong about taking whatever measures are necessary to secure the return of their sailors, portend an increasingly volatile oil market for the foreseeable future. Meanwhile, while the future of the planet now seems to revolve on the fate of the 15 British sailors who are reported to be safe and well-fed, hundreds of Sudanese continue to be shot, tortured, run from their homes, and raped by the rapacious Janjaweed, backed by the Sudanese president, who was recently awarded a promise of a grand new palace by the Chinese, who are aggressively using the newly cleared lands as a reasonable opportunity to extend their search for and development of oil refineries in southern Sudan. Turning our attention to other emerging stories, thousands of environmentalists and people who have discussed the challenges of global warming and climate change are having to answer charges that, contrary to what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have to say about listing the polar bear on the endangered species list, stories are that polar bear populations are in fact increasing, even booming, according to people wishing to make the case that it's all a bunch of hooey. The source for this story, reported on Fox News and Ann Coulter's favorite newspaper, The Washington Times, turns out to be, according to the article's author, Gene Muller, a pro-hunting group in the U.S. and more than one Canadian expert. Meanwhile, dwindling sea ice is posing problems for the baby harp seals, strangely making it impossible for the usual contingent of club-swinging harp seal harvesters to carry out their infanticide by walking on the top of the frozen seas to reach their prey. But with the ice shelf breaking up early and drifting away, thousands of baby harp seals are feared drowned. Although the tally is not in yet, this still may be far less than the 350,000 harp seals that are clubbed to death and skinned each year. In an effort to help secure caribou and moose populations in Alaska, which have recently not been meeting their projected populations, the state of Alaska has set a bounty of $150 for each wolf killed under a predator reduction program. Alaska is estimated to contain between 7,000 and 11,000 wolves. The program, which will reward hunters who bring in a hind leg from their killed wolves, hopes to kill upwards of 600 wolves. The legs will be used for wolf research, making the taking appear part of a larger scientific inquiry. And in South Dakota, sunflower growers, seeing a sudden increase in demand for sunflower oil for making potato chips with less saturated fat, are seeking help from the state in reducing the blackbird populations by millions of birds in order to increase the return on crop investments. With Frito-Lay's decision to use New Sun oil to cook its potato chips, the production of sunflowers is expected to explode. However, the blackbirds, which love sunflower seeds much the same as humans do, can reduce overall production by as much as 5 to 8%. Strategies to diminish the populations include noise cannons, but as well, the poisoning of pea gravel along highways. It seems the blackbirds consume quite a bit of the gravel to aid in their digestion. Opponents of this program fear that poison gravel could possibly have an undesirable effect on animals which otherwise don't really pay much mind to sunflowers. And finally, a federal judge ruled Friday that the Army Corps of Engineers issued permits illegally to 4 mining companies which rely on mountaintop removal to get to their coal, in violation of requirements to determine whether the dirt, rocks, and other materials removed to clear a mountain can be dumped into the nearby valleys in order to expedite the removal of the coal. The courts determined that the Corps' mitigation procedures to restore the areas failed to adequately take into consideration the full extent of possible impacts resulting from the destruction of headwater streams within a watershed. And that's the news. And a few reminders. The Wildside News is happy to announce that starting in May, every show will bring you directly to a briefing from 10 of the world's leading authorities in global warming, conservation, ecology, action, spirit, and the state of the world as we launch the weekly Earth Summit. We will be telling you more each week as we get ready to air the most important 10 minutes on Earth, the weekly Earth Summit, each week, here on the Wild Side News. One of my favorite topics is the area of research, and actually it's just part of life, which is the animals and their full complexity and their richness in terms of what they bring to us. And I'm talking about all creatures. And I, for some reason, came into this life with a total fascination about animals and as some sort of a quest and an appreciation to understand what in the world they are, how they function, how they operate, what makes them go. And it's been a lifelong quest. I share this passion with someone who I'm getting to know very well, who is one of my favorite people to talk to for a whole lot of reasons. And this is Dr. Mark Beckhoff, who has written a new book called The Emotional Lives of Animals, And we're going to have a great discussion about that topic right now. Dr. Beckhoff, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Wow, I'm glad to be here again, Sydney. I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you so much. First of all, you've written a new book, and we're going to be kind of focusing on that, The Emotional Lives of Animals. And this is what I'm going to say about the book. And this is not pandering. This is a book that virtually everybody should read for a number of reasons. One is that it's a fascinating, fast read, easy read. It's not heavy and deep into science and the scientific method. It is, and we'll talk about why that is too. But as well, it carries a message that is so close to me, which is the fact that animals, yes, indeed, do have very rich, full spectrum of emotional expression. First of all, give us a little background about what brought you to this. You, like I, have shared some sort of innate passion about understanding animals.
Right. Well, to give an autobiography, my parents tell me that when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I was always asking them what other animals felt and what other animals thought. And I wrote a book in 2002 called Minding Animals, and actually that phrase came from the long conversations that I had with my parents. You know, my mother was actually afraid of dogs, having been bitten when she was young. She just developed a long-term fear. My father loved dogs. My grandparents had a dog. But at the time, I was only raised with a goldfish. And I would run around saying, "What do you think he's feeling? What do you think he's thinking?" And, of course, people would look at me like I was nuts. But my folks said that, you know, they could never, they just never really put anything directly straight, you know, straight to me that would result in that. So the big picture is I think I was raised in a house with a lot of love and compassion, a lot of peace, you know, a lot of, you know, if you will, anti-war sort of sentiments, conscientious objector type sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best answer I can come up with, Sydney, that it's just been one of those situations where I just always have empathized. And I think in my book I also write about mirror neurons, which we'll get to sometime.
Yes.
So when I tell people that I can feel another person's or another animal's pain, I actually really, I really mean that, as fluffy as it sounds.
For people who may not know, I do have a degree in biology, and I will say this, if I had gone on to graduate school, which for some reason I didn't, I went to the University of Minnesota, which has a great biology department, but had I done so, I would have majored in ethology, the study of animal behavior, which is your forte. And I'm also going to say this, that what we're going to talk about today, from my perspective, is the most important topic on Earth. You can talk about war, we can talk about poverty, we can talk about globalization, we can talk about global warming, etc., the death of the animals, etc., but I think perhaps the secret to all of this has to do with the concept that we simply must come to understand that the animals that surround us, the beings, these creatures, are trying to reach. My take on this, Mark, is that our lives are shallower because they're kind of waiting for us to communicate with them. They're communicating with us all the time. But for reasons that come a lot from science, unfortunately, we have a wall. We've created a wall. And you certainly talk about that in your book, which, of course, everyone knows is this concept of anthropomorphizing. Let's get into that a little bit, because as just with you, I share the fact that scientists are the ones who are building this wall, and it's been a very, very difficult arena to penetrate the concept of anthropomorphizing. How is it that you, as a scientist, what kind of wars have you had to fight to try to get people to realize that animals do have emotions?
You know, there's been a number of walls. The first is very simple, and that just comes back to when I'm studying animals, naming them, you know, instead of numbering them. You know, so the first thing would be that I watch animals and I name them because they're subjects of a life. They're not objects, if you will. So, you know, giving them a name. In my book and elsewhere, I've written about a cat who I named Speedo, who was a real rapid learner. It came time to sacrifice him or kill him, and he looked at me in the eyes. He locked eyes with me and basically said to me, "You can't do this. You know, you just cannot do this. It is wrong for you to do this." And so, you know, it was partially because I had named him and he took on a personality. So, you know, that's one resistance that comes. And, of course, if you, Jane Goodall, of course, was notorious for having come out of the field to complete her PhD at Cambridge University, and she was had named all the animals, and they all had personalities, and the people at Cambridge said, you know, you can't do that, that's unscientific. The other, of course, is just the concept of anthropomorphism, you know, attributing human characteristics to animals. And my take on that, of course, is, number one, we have to be anthropomorphic, and we have to do it from the animal's point of view, but we have to use words with which we're familiar in the language we know. So part of that resistance to that is some people say, well, we should just describe the behavior, or we should describe the firing of muscles or the firing of neurons, or provide data on body temperature or something like that, or brain waves, EEGs. But, of course, that doesn't give you any context. So what I favor is the principle called biocentric anthropomorphism, which means being anthropomorphic and really taking the time to learn, you know, about the animal. The other thing, of course, is that some of the critics will, you know, come to me when I say, hey, look at that elephant in the zoo. She's unhappy. And they'll go, oh, you're just being anthropomorphic. She's very happy. And I, when I first heard that, I knew there was something wrong, but, you know, frankly, sometimes it doesn't register. But, of course, what's wrong is, why is it anthropomorphic to say that an elephant is unhappy, but it's not anthropomorphic to say that an elephant is happy?
Of course, the obvious answer is you can't prove it scientifically, and that's part of the challenge, is the fact that, and this is where I have a difficult time with the scientists, is that if they can't prove it, they say it doesn't exist. I'm always intrigued by the fact that scientists announce discoveries such as that animals actually can think in perhaps some complex fashion, or that they perhaps may be able to use tools. And part of the story that you certainly talk about is the fact that there's such a difference between scientists as they're talking to scientists and trying to be a scientist, and we love scientists, we know plenty of great scientists, certainly. But then when you talk to them about what's happening with their animals at home, it's as if they live in two different worlds and they can't put the two together. That is part of the challenge, that there is this disconnect between their human experience and then how they describe the same animal and their behaviors when they're talking to scientists.
In my book, I have a story of a friend of mine named Bill, it's not his real name, and his dog Reno. And the story goes that right before I gave a talk, I knew Bill and I had met Reno previously. Bill came up to me and told me how smart Reno was and how emotional he was and how he loved to play and how he got really upset when Bill gave attention to his daughter, and when Bill left him at home for a real long time, he got angry. And, you know, suffered from separation anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. So I gave my talk, and I freely said, of course we know that dogs and chimpanzees have, and say elephants have emotions, and recently we've discovered that mice show empathy. So I gave the talk, and afterwards Bill raised his hand and said, oh, Mark, you're just being anthropomorphic, et cetera, et cetera. And I just looked at him. And I said, Bill, do you want to tell the audience about what you told me about your dog, Reno? And he said, oh, you know what I mean. And I went, no, I don't know what you mean. So there was an example of this kind of angst and schizophrenia that a lot of researchers have, that the dog at home is different from the dog in the lab. The dog at home has a personality. You can name the dog. They experience a wide range of emotions, but the dog in the laboratory is some kind of objectified object, a creature with who's numbered, who doesn't have feelings.
Some of the good news is this war against anthropomorphizing by scientists is diminishing significantly.
Oh, hugely. It's really hard to find anybody who really comes out and says, you never can do this, it is wrong.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the alternatives they offer, Sydney, just don't work.
Right.
Yeah, no, of course. It's really getting... And also because people are becoming more careful using it. And there's also been a new finding in humans using functional magnetic resonance imaging that shows that when we anthropomorphize, the emotional part of the brain lights up. And so in my book, I argue that the reason we anthropomorphize is because we feel. We also anthropomorphize nature, angry thunderstorms, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a human tendency. I recently wrote a paper with a friend of mine, and what we concluded is that being anthropomorphic is doing what comes naturally. There's a lot of evidence that our ancestors started being anthropomorphic when they hunted, and they had to learn how to predict and understand the behavior of prey animals.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, of course it does. So, you know, to be honest with you, combined with the what I call that anthropomorphic doublespeak, you can say an elephant's happy, but you can't say she's unhappy. And combined with the lack of any kind of alternative, I don't pay any attention anymore to the critics. It's a waste of time.
I agree with you. It's this is another thing that you covered in your book, which I didn't know. I haven't had a chance to read Darwin. For whatever reason it is, I guess I don't have the time. But you thank you for sharing the fact that he actually was one of the people who really began to classify, as he was classifying everything, the emotional content of animals. He had six emotions, and as I mentioned these, I just want each one of you to think about these terms, and then as well as they apply to the animals that you know. Anger, happiness, sadness, disgust, fear, and surprise. Anyone who has had any experience with animals can say, yes, I've seen my animal angry. I certainly have seen my animal happy, sadness, disgusted with things, fearful, and surprise. But then as well, it goes on, and new terms have been added. The concepts of jealousy,
right,
contempt, shame, embarrassment. This really adds on to those other concepts. And then as well, sympathy, guilt, pride, envy, admiration, and indignation. I believe that, to a large extent, all of these I've seen in some form or another in animals. And why don't we start to look at some of these? Now, you have had the opportunity to really study these different emotional expressions, and you've particularly focused on the area of play, which I find as well fascinating. Let's start to look at some of this topic from the perspective of your perspective as a scientist and how you've gone about looking into the emotional lives of animals.
Right. The topic I've studied the most is animal play behavior, which, of course, is related to animal joy and happiness and pleasure. And so I'm still studying play, still trying to learn about it about 35 years later.
Mm.
But over the course of the decade, the first thing we did was we filmed animals and saw what they did. Takes a lot of patience and time. And watching a video of an hour of dog play could literally take 20 or 30 hours to analyze, because they do stuff that requires detailed analysis.
And you're really slowing these down almost on a frame-to-frame basis, looking for very micro behaviors.
Right. We do frame by frame, exactly, not even quarter time. And then what we do is, you know, we see what they do. We see how they incorporate the different moves in play. And then, of course, because play in animals incorporates actions from different contexts, we need to be very careful to honor the fact that these animals are facing a very difficult task. So, for example, a bite could be used in predatory behavior or in dominance, as could be a hip slam. A mounting is usually used in reproductive behavior. But during play, they incorporate all the actions from different contexts. So how do they know they're playing and not fighting or trying to mate or eat one another? So we began that analysis by looking at a new set of sequences. And then we also were concerned with how animals communicate their intention to play. How do I tell you I want to play with you? How do I tell you that I'm sorry I bit you, or I bit you very hard, but let's play?
It's a very complex behavior, play. And
right.
You go into that in your book in such a marvelous way, because there's all sorts of rules. There has to be rules.
Right, exactly. There have to be rules. And the way that the animals live by the rules, of course, is that they, number one, agree to cooperate. They, number two, use certain signals to say, I'm going to play, let's play, don't interpret a bite as, an aggressive move. And then they'll use what I call the play bow when they crouch on the forelimbs and put their butts up in the air. They not only use that to solicit play, but they use that right before or right after they've bit an animal very hard. And so what that is saying is, Sydney, I'm going to bite you, but don't take it as, say, a dominance move. Or, Sydney, I'm sorry I bit you. You know, I bite you hard, and you look at me, you make eye contact, and you go, what are you doing? That's not play. And I go, yes, it's play. I'm sorry. So play requires a very careful fine-tuning and coordination of the behavior. It requires the ability to forgive and to accept forgiveness and to apologize. incorporates trust. And so I developed in Chapter 4 of my new book this concept of wild justice, in which the animals can play fairly, they can play roughly, but, you know, they need to play fairly so that play doesn't escalate into aggression, for example. And the fact of the matter is, although everyone who goes to a dog park or has watched animals says that play frequently escalates into aggression, the fact is it rarely does.
That's true.
We've collected data on this, and you tend to remember it because it's so rare. So after decades of looking at what animals do when they play and how they play with one another and maintain the play atmosphere, we now believe that they are moral, that there's a sense of morality, and that they know right from wrong.
Now, it's interesting because as a scientist, we believe that there is this process of natural selection, that somehow if these behaviors exist, they have been selected for, as opposed to if they don't exist, they would be selected out. And I believe that. There's absolute truth in that.
Exactly. If they don't work, they don't stay.
Exactly.
No, exactly.
And so the next question that would kind of logically flow would be, what selective advantage would playing have in terms of adding some sort of selective advantage to an animal species? So let's talk about dogs. How might play actually help these animals in terms of their species survival?
Right. That's a great question. It's very difficult to assign one general function, if you will, to play. And so the way we look at it, you know, in the field is that play is important in social development, the development of social skills, socialization, social communication skills. It's important in physical development. It provides anaerobic and aerobic exercise. It's important in what's called the training response, builds joints, muscles, and tendons and bones, for example. It's also important in cognitive development, learning concepts. I call it eye-paw coordination. Animals learn to negotiate their environment like we might call it eye-hand coordination. And a couple years ago, some colleagues and I put forth a theory of play that's very ubiquitous, very broad, and it says that play trains animals for unexpected circumstances. And that has really caught on. And the reason it is because play is so variable. Mm-hmm. And because it uses actions from many different social contexts, mm-hmm. it really does allow the animals to prepare and to behave flexibly and variably in situations that are unpredictable.
Well, you know, it's now I'm, I don't know what the term for this is, but now I'm going to, like, take the animal behaviors and apply them to our own, because there's a back and forth. There's anthropomorphizing, but there's perhaps animal, I don't know, you maybe have a term for it, but applying these things to ourselves. Children as well play.
Oh,
and I think back at when I was playing, and as you say, it's extremely experimental. You know, you're trying all sorts of things, and you're trying them out, and you're finding out, you're getting a feedback loop about what's acceptable and what's not.
Exactly. Right, and the people who have, a lot of people, I mean, frankly, a lot of people have been quite interested in this work. A lot of the interest comes from developmental psychologists who are seeing the same thing on the playground.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
With human kids.
By the way, the book is rich in filling out all of this information, and although we have an hour here, we're only going to hit about 2% of what I'd really like to talk with you about. But we have been taught from day one concept of the survival of the fittest, and there's sort of a natural interpretation about that means the strongest, the bravest, the healthiest, and as well those that can subdue and even slay any sort of adversaries. But you bring into this another concept of survival of the fittest, and that has to be the survival of the fittest when it comes to cooperation. I think that's such a brilliant reinterpretation of survival of the fittest.
Well, one of the things that we're really interested in this notion of wild justice is placing cooperation and fairness in the context of the evolution of behavior. The survival of the fittest, the competitive paradigm, still predominates. But it's not so that it's the only show in town. So, of course, there's competition among animals, but there's also a lot of cooperation. And anybody who knows evolutionary theory knows that it would be impossible for behavior to persist if it was always aggression, aggression, aggression. At some point, it would just escalate to the point where it would just be weeded out of the repertoire.
Well, they'd kill themselves off.
Yeah, they would. And in other aspects, some people call it runaway selection. An anatomical example of runaway selection might be the huge antlers that just got bigger and bigger on Irish elk until they couldn't carry their heads upright. We need balance for the competitive nature, and we look at cooperation, and we don't view cooperation as being a sideshow. In other words, cooperation in and of itself is important in the evolution of behavior. Without the balance, we wouldn't get anywhere. And actually, among a lot of species, and now I present data in my book from studies of different monkeys, social carnivores such as wolves, hyenas, their social interactions are predominantly cooperative. But once again, you know, a big fight is really an attention getter, and that's what people tend to remember. So the big picture here is that cooperation is key. There's been strong selection for it in evolution, and that it's not a sideshow to just competition.
Well, in our own societies, there's this backwards-forwards loop that we learn about the animals, but as well in the process of learning about them, we learn about ourselves, which I think is part of the big, huge message here. Look at our own society, for example. I am personally amazed at the degree to which humans cooperate. Mm-hmm. As I'm driving, I live here in San Diego, and as I'm driving down the freeway, and I see literally endless streams of cars going 70, 80, 85 miles an hour, and somehow we're all in some sort of unspoken cooperation. We're driving together. And then you get that one jerk who's weaving in and out, and all of a sudden we start to get a little angry, don't we?
Yes.
We react to those that go beyond the rules. Or another example that I like to think about is standing in line. We have an unwritten law. No one has to teach us exactly. We're all standing in line to buy a movie ticket, and then, you know, that jerk that decides that they're going to butt ahead of us, I'm sorry, but my hackles go up.
Yes.
And so that's unsocial behavior.
Yes.
And so likewise, we survive in our societies because we have these instincts to get along, to cooperate, and they work, and they lead to an ongoing society. And I think exactly the same thing happens within the animal communities as well. So how do animals show their emotions? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Shadows and footprints, mine in the waters of mystery, deep as the endless sea, and older than time. Islands in motion, wells of the ocean, forgive our greed. We're more than we'll ever need, and still we're so blind.